So good morning, good morning, and a very warm welcome to today's session with Rick. I hope not too many of you awoke and set off an hour early this morning. Really great to have Rick with us again today. Those who were here yesterday will know that we had a really terrific day and really looking forward to today's teaching and practice. Three practical announcements. Firstly, that we're trying to do something about the heating in here. So hopefully it should get cooler as the moon recedes. Secondly, the toilets, for those who weren't here yesterday, are on this floor, go through the two sets of double doors in that direction and just follow the signs round. I think we are going to have some breaks today, is that right?
I learned from yesterday. Do little breaks.
But as there are so many of us here, probably it's a good thing if we're not all piling towards the loo at the same moment. So if you do need to go to the loo during the day, do feel welcome to get up in the middle and go out. That's really fine. And last thing, just the perennial reminder about mobile phones. So Rick, over to you. Thank you so much.
Does everybody have a handout, by the way?
Good morning. By the way, how is the lighting for you in terms of seeing the slides? Not great. Maybe we can make it a smidge darker.
A little darker?
A smidge? Maybe over there, perhaps, so people can see over here. Well, of course, you won't be able to see over there. So. It's dukkha, right? You know, suffering, first noble truth. A little detail. Do you know the root of the word dukkha? It's actually quite wonderful teaching. So, just to kind of create a bit of a context here. How's that, by the way, lighting? Now it's too dark? I beg your pardon? The back ones were on earlier, Chris, so they were good?
That's it. Yeah.
That's the ticket. And then that off?
The light is really eccentric, so is it one cut?
Can we turn these guys off now?
That one off.
All right, that's good. Well, just to reset it, then I'll say a word about myself and what we're doing here. As you probably know, 2,500 years ago, the Buddha made an observation that seems obvious in retrospect, which is that life contains suffering. And that word suffering, in some ways, is probably an excessive translation of the original word in Pali, the language of the earliest surviving written record of the Buddhist teachings. And the original word is dukkha, which can also be translated more as closer to stress or discontent or unsatisfactoriness. And the root of the word dukkha, the etymological root of the word, is that it's two parts, de and ka. De means sort of wrong or bad or not working right, okay? Not morally wrong, just not working right. And ka is the intersection between a hub and a wheel. So dukkha is a kind of wobbly grinding. So always a little imbalance, no matter what you do, whether it's the lighting in the room or the temperature, etc. Although it is really charming and nice when occasionally you can get it just right. But have you ever noticed that it never lasts? Right? There's always something coming anyway. So that's the root. I think about that as a wobbly grinding. It's really getting at some kind of inherent quality in much of experience, amidst many other things, many other satisfactions, many other pleasures, many other fulfillments. But still there is that wobbly grinding that persists, and what shall we do about it? Right? That's the great problem. That's the fact of suffering, broadly defined. Okay, and one of the main sources of suffering, if you will, certainly Buddhism, its phrase, its frame, and I think Buddhism sees it that way because it is that way. A major source of suffering, of dukkha, the wobbly grinding, is this perennial sense of me, myself, and I. All right, that's what today's focus is on. The persistent sense of being a being who's looking out through one's eyes, of being the owner of experiences and the agent of actions, the one to whom things happen. You know, the I in I want a cookie, or the me in do you love me, right? And we're going to explore that perennial sense today which is arguably one of the slipperiest subjects of all, both in Buddhism and in psychology. And so this particular workshop is about the various things I do or teach is my personal favorite because it deals with the thorniest subjects and in a way that I think is productive in terms of looking at this thorny subject through the lens of neuroscience. There's been a major intersection, if you will, between neuroscience and Buddhism or the contemplative traditions broadly in the last dozen years. I think some of that intersection is not very useful, but there are certain areas where I think it is very useful, and I hope you see why as we go along. So that's the setup about myself. Just a quick question. How many of you were here yesterday? Okay, roughly two-thirds, three-quarters. That's great. I'll just reintroduce myself again for a moment here. So I'm a neuropsychologist professionally and have been practicing in various ways since about 1974. I was introduced to Eastern spiritual traditions in my last quarter at UCLA. I was a senior. It was very romantic. I learned how to meditate sitting on hills around Southern California, playing my flute with long hair, you know, reading Three Pillars of Zen and Alan Watts and Ram Dass and all the classic good stuff, all the Huxley, perennial philosophy and so forth. Anyway, that's really kind of the began for me. Along the way, I've always been deeply interested in the brain. I remember reading books about the brain a long time ago, even in my 20s. And then in the last 10 or so years, in parallel with the explosion of knowledge about the 3 pounds of tofu, you know, right, in between years, in the last 10 years, I've gotten extremely interested in the applications. How do we actually use the implications of neuroscience? In other words, how do we take these deep accounts of happiness and suffering that are found in both Western psychology, which I'm trained in as a clinical psychologist and a practicing therapist, not an academic, I'm a clinician fundamentally. How do we use the deep modeling of the mind of happiness and suffering that's found in Western psychology as well as in the contemplative traditions worldwide, not just in Buddhism, although Buddhism is the one I know best and it's the one that's had the most intersection with Western psychology, I think in large part because it shares common values of empiricism and pragmatism, you know, just the facts. Show me the facts, man, or sir. The question is, of course, how to take those accounts, right? The Western psychological accounts of suffering and happiness and the Eastern or the Buddhist account of suffering and happiness and embed it in evolutionary neuropsychology. It's kind of a mouthful. That's what I'm talking about here. It's how to take these accounts, ground them in the science of how the brain evolved over time, driven by its functional purposes, its adaptations, right, which lead us to suffer, alas, in many ways. And then by really, and then based on that account, how to then do the practical thing? How to then say, okay, given that account of what the brain is doing when we're suffering or when we're truly happy, how do we then go after the neural substrates of true happiness? And how do we go after the neural substrates of suffering to fiddle with them and change them? How do we actually do that in practical ways? In other words, how do we, over time, use the mind to change the brain, to change the mind for the better? Based on some increasingly skillful understanding of the dotted lines that connect mental activity to neural activity to mental activity. So that increasingly we're not at the effect, we're not a nail to the hammer of neural psychological processes, neural mental processes. We're increasingly not at the effect of them, but we're increasingly in the driver of the chariot, all right, the chariot seat, to use the Buddhist metaphor. So that's what I'm interested in, that's what has engaged me, and that's what I hope we get to do today. So in terms of topics, these are the topics I hope to cover. Self in the mind, in other words, self, quote unquote, as its experience, then self as it's observed in the brain through very interesting and powerful neurological studies. And then I want to address the paradox that to free the self, if you will, we need to feed the self first. As someone observed, you need to have an ego in order to transcend the ego. And one of the things that helps free selfing as a gerund, if you will, relating to self more as process, more as verb than as noun, which is a notion we'll be exploring later. An important step in doing it, actually, is to take in healthy narcissistic supplies that are often in short supply, unfortunately, for a large fraction, I think probably about 90% at least of the population. And then on the basis of that, I want to explore two major neural networks in the brain that are involved with doing, quote unquote, on the one hand and being on the other, as a prelude or setup to doing practices that help us abide increasingly, as the Buddha told Bahia in the opening slide here, such that in the seen there is only the seen, in the thought only the thought, in the sensed only the sensed, so that there's no either, there's no presumption of either. And if I-ing, self-ing arises, it seems just another mental content coming and going, like as I said earlier, like a cloud passing through the sky of awareness. So it's an ambitious aim, right? And I'll try to learn from yesterday. We'll have little breaks in the morning and the afternoon. As usual, I probably tried to fill my cup with way too much. You know, in Buddhism, there are like these three psychological types: greed types, hatred types, and delusion types. I'm more of a greed type. You know, I want to fill the cup. But here we go. Rather do too much than too little. Okay? So, diving in. I want to offer some perspectives first, kind of fairly briskly. As I alluded to earlier, we're going to work at the center of these three circles. You saw the slide yesterday. Contemplative practice, Buddhism in particular, psychology and neurology. And then, there, though, we will really focus on, especially when we deal with a murky subject like self, the I. We really want to try to stay close to what's your direct experience. And in this, I'm not trying to persuade you of anything. As the Buddha said famously in the Pali word, ehi pasiko, see for yourself. See for yourself which will occur for you. This is a really great quote, as you know, and it's really also at the heart of the Western scientific tradition, too. Okay. So a quick summary of what we talked about yesterday in terms of self-directed neuroplasticity. On the one hand, as the brain changes, the mind changes. Okay? On the other hand, here's Chris helping me change my brain or my body, because I have a little bit of a cold and a dripping nose. So I got my little supplies here. All right. That's good. Thank you, Chris. So on the other hand, as the mind changes, the brain changes. And the mind can change the brain in lasting ways. In other words, in the traditional saying, the mind takes the shape of what it rests upon, for better or worse. Or to update that in the frame of evolutionary neuropsychology, the brain takes the shape of what the mind rests upon. In other words, your mental activity, what you do today, or what you do in practice, can change your brain over time in very wholesome ways. It's also the case, that's kind of the fact on the ground in a wake-up call, that what the mind rests upon can also change the brain in negative ways. You know, if we routinely rest upon unwholesome desires, aversive, hateful, broadly defined, reactions to other people, or, you know, twirls of deluded ignorant thought, we unfortunately stimulate those neural substrates. And if you stimulate them, because neurons that fire together wire together, you also strengthen them and build them out, even to the point of measurably thickening cortical layers. So based on that, great opportunity we have. There's an interesting slide that I also showed yesterday, and I'll do this one just very quickly, as a demonstration of how meditation changes the brain. It does so in a variety of ways. There's a lot of research, actually, of all the mental activities. The one that's been studied the most in terms of its impact on the brain is meditation. Partly because it's kind of cool to study it, and also because people initially wanted to debunk it, but they discovered over time that meditation can make many fundamental, lasting changes in the brain. Here we can see three. The area that's circled with the one is the insula. It's a part of the brain that tracks the interior state of the body, gut feelings, inner emotions, as well as empathy for the feelings of other people. The second region that's strengthened through long-term mindfulness practice or meditation practice is the executive regions of the brain in the very front that control attention. You know, mindfulness is applied attention. And then the third region is the somatosensory cortex up at the top. People tend to tune into their bodies, although you don't need to tune into your body, of course, to do different meditative practices. On the bottom, we can see that in contrast to the blue square folks, these are the controls, the blue dot meditators over time did not experience in these regions normal cortical thinning due to age. As I mentioned yesterday, we lose about 10,000 brain cells a day, but if you start with 1.1 trillion upstairs, you've only lost about 4% by your 80th birthday under normal conditions. But there is cortical thinning, which is associated with subtleties of cognitive decline as we age. Interestingly, the people that worked those parts of their brain, much like working on muscle in the gym, used it so they did not lose it over time. Or as Minsky said, you know, he's the kind of godfather of cognitive science, at least in America, you know, the principal activities of brains are making changes in themselves. Now, just quick here, you know, I talked about the physical effects of meditation. This is a quick list. We'll spend a lot of time here. The interesting thing to appreciate here as well is that meditation is fantastic stress relief. A lot of the benefits of meditation for long-term mental and physical health, and there are many studies that, by the way, a resource for you is my website. You can reach it either with my name, Rick Hansen, OM.net, or just BuddhasBrain.com, which will take you there. I list a bunch of resources there, including the slide sets from many workshops I've given, and some talks are freely offered. You're welcome to share them with others. It's kind of a Dana model, you know, it's freely offered. Dana's the Pali word for generosity. Also, there are listed a number of sort of greatest hit scientific papers that are in the public domain. And the references for a lot of these things are in those papers, and they're also in the last several slides of this handout. You can see those there. Quick sidebar, let's see, we will email you the slides from yesterday and today unless you don't want to receive them, and which is fine. Also, I will automatically subscribe you to the Wise Brain Bulletin, which is put out by the Institute I founded, and to the Just One Thing newsletter I have, which does a practice each week. This week's practice is see the being behind the eyes. Last week's practice is notice you're all right now. I think the practice that's coming up is something like give no person cause to fear you. Maybe that's not it. I forget. But anyway, the point is, I don't share your email address with anybody. I really respect privacy. It's easy to unsubscribe from me. And if you don't want, if you want just the slides, let's say, or you want just the newsletters, or you want neither, just say, leave a note for Chris, and that'll work out.
Yeah, we'll put a pad up here, so if anybody doesn't want, actually, we'll put it on the table. And if anybody doesn't want to receive those, just write your name. You don't need to write your email address. We thought that's easier than anybody else.
Yeah, and no shame in it. It's really okay. We were not looking at your names and putting you on some kind of bad list. Okay. Anyway, go back to here. Okay, so anyway, the point is, a lot of the benefits of meditation honestly travel through very familiar stress relief pathways. It's not so much that meditation is special. Meditation is special in certain regards. But there are a lot of the benefits of meditation are non-specific to meditation. If you did other forms of stress relief activities, you'd also get those benefits. It's just that when we do meditation, in part for its specific benefits, we also get these non-specific benefits as well. Okay. Now, over time, what we do, and this is a nice traditional saying that I got from one of my main teachers, Christina Feldman, who's one of the teachers here in England, or in Great Britain. In this traditional saying, first you know the mind. That's where we start. You've got to know the mind. And in the beginning, it's a mess in there, isn't it? It's like a zoo. It's like a jungle. A bunch of crazed animals jumping up and down. Inner iguana, you know, little worms crawling around. I pointed out yesterday that we share about 20% of our DNA with bananas. You know, it's the inner banana. I don't know. Something like that. What's a very English flower or plant or something?
Rose.
Rose. The inner rose. That's somehow more romantic than banana. But anyway. All right. So we had to know it initially. And then over time, we start trying to get a hold of the zoo, if you will, and try to shape it in one direction. So we shape the mind. And as I said, in effect, we're shaping the brain. And the ultimate point of that is to free the mind. You know, these practices are, in the Buddhist metaphor, very much rafts to get us across the ocean of suffering. Yet on the other side of the river, we don't keep carrying the raft around. You know, they're seen as intermediate practices. We don't get stuck in there. A fellow yesterday asked a question that I've been thinking about since, and I realized I kind of missed part of what he was going at. He was sitting over there, and I don't think it's you. He asked about Soto Zen, the notion of just practicing for its own sake. And I think what he is getting at, actually, is this notion or balance or tension you see often people raising in terms of practice, which This gentleman actually got a cheeky question yesterday that spoke to it as well, which is, how do we balance just simply dropping into our already awakened nature with being on a path that's progressive and developmental? Right? And I think we balance it by recognizing that both are true. And the Buddha clearly, and I think in ways that sometimes get misinterpreted, sometimes in circles, particularly non-dual circles, if you will, the Buddha used the language of path continually, developmental process, cultivation. You know, wise effort is a gradual process of pulling weeds and planting flowers in the mind, which means pulling weeds and planting flowers in the brain. There is a progressive process. It's okay. We can look back and see, hopefully, that we've come some distance from where we were, you know, a decade or two ago. And we can see ahead of us that while we may be in the, you know, we've come up from the dusty plains, we're in the foothills, or even in the lower mountains, that there are higher snowy peaks. And there are people who clearly hang out there in the higher peaks, even all the way to the tippy top of Mount Everest. So there is a progressive process, without a doubt. On the other hand, there is the registration, often, of, wow, the way it actually really is right now. And, you know, in a way that's quite profound. And I like the traditional saying as well, I think it's from Tibet, you know, gradual cultivation, sudden awakening, gradual cultivation, sudden awakening, gradual cultivation, sudden awakening, gradual cultivation. You know, it's a progressive process. Both are important and involved in this. It's not either or. You know, obviously, there are pitfalls in either one. Just wanting to drop into, like sometimes you hear teachers say in certain traditions, oh, just recognize your true nature right now. Don't do any practices. Of course, they usually say that having done 30 years of practices, having had an awakening on the bus or something, and then say, oh, don't do practices. You don't need any practices. Well, how did your own apple get so ripe that it just fell from the tree by grace? Maybe grace is involved in the falling of the apple, but the apple is ready to fall based on causes and conditions. Suffering and happiness arise due to causes and conditions which are embedded in nature, embedded in the body, in physicality, notably in the brain. We need to change those causes and conditions progressively over time. On the other hand, there are pitfalls in endless seeking and striving, you know, which are kind of dualistic. The goal is over there, lousy me is over here, poor pathetic me. Notice the selfing in that. There's a lot of selfing in poor pathetic me, right? And people can get caught up in striving, and self-criticism for how they're not progressing on the path. There are pitfalls on either side. Just because there are pitfalls, though, doesn't mean that we don't recognize the truth, that there is both sudden awakening and gradual cultivation, and they nourish each other. So, how about we do a practice, and in this practice, I'll start with some basics of meditation, and then I'll go into, I think, 5 suggestions. Yeah, for how to nourish the neural substrates of mindful awareness. Right? As a little demonstration of how you can use your mind to change your brain in very specific and targeted ways, which then benefit the mind. Because, as you probably noticed, and how many of you meditate at least once a month? At least once a month, a minute a month. That's the standard, that's the bar, we're going to leave it at that. You know, we won't be, no personal interviews, you know. We won't be emailing your teacher with what your real practice is or whatever, okay? So that's good, so you know what we're talking about. You probably noticed that meditation sometimes is not easy, right? In fact, often the mind wants to skitter around. We did not evolve to meditate. You know, our ancestors that were very meditative and absorbed, they got eaten, right? So the ones that were more distractible and vigilant and scanning and quickly satiated and stimuli and were looking around, you know, they lived to see the sunrise, and here we are today, okay? So, you know, it's not quite natural to, for example, pick something like the breath and lock onto it for 5 minutes straight, which I'll suggest that you do after we set up this kind of neural substrate. So this practice will last about 12 to 15 minutes tops. And as we get to the breath part, just the pure breath, I will suggest that you stay with each and every breath from beginning to end for 5 minutes. That's about 75 breaths at the normal, at the average pace of the way people breathe. A little detail on that, if you've never tried to do that as a concentration practice, it's actually quite great because it's remarkable how quickly the mind goes away. It tends to go away usually between the fourth and the sixth breath. Right? You probably noticed that. So knowing that, you can help yourself by particularly watching that threshold. You can use little practices, if you like, to stay with the breath itself. like counting each breath up to 10 and starting over, or counting down from 10, 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, rather than 1, 2, 3, up. If you lose track, just start over. That's a method you might softly note in the back of your mind as you breathe in, out, or rising, falling. That's okay. Or if you don't care to do that, if you find that distracting. I myself find that counting the breaths is useful sometimes, distracting at other times. You know, you can simply give yourself over to the breath. Think of it as a kind of devotion to practice, where for this duration, you give yourself over to the breath and you renounce everything else. Concentration is a kind of renunciation. Okay? We give ourselves over to the breath or whatever the object of awareness is, and we renounce everything else. Okay. Important point, I will talk about the breath as the object of awareness, or I'll talk about tuning into the body in various ways. For many people, that's a great object of awareness. For some people, though, particularly if you've had any kind of painful history, even a traumatic one, tuning into the body or tuning into the breath can feel kind of alarming. So feel very free here, as with anything I say today, to, you know, ehi pasiko, you know, see for yourself and go your own way. Feel free to adapt my suggestions, find a different object of awareness if it's uncomfortable to pay attention to breathing, such as the sensations in your feet, or open your eyes and just kind of gaze at something benign on the wall, or maybe have a saying in your mind, focus on that. Like, you know, may I be happy, may I feel at ease, or may all beings be at peace. Or an image, maybe a tree, a garden, a rose, an English rose, or a friend, or a teacher, or an image of the Buddha, perhaps, or any other religious iconography, whatever works for you. Okay? Enough preludes. How we begin. So if you could, eyes open or closed, and if they're open, you might pick a relaxed gaze, maybe a few feet in front of you. Come into your body, come into a sense of presence. Here we are, right now. Seeing if you can find some basic goodwill for yourself. Maybe starting with a sense of goodwill that's easy to access, perhaps for a person you care a lot about, even a pet perhaps, and then moving to a sense of that same experience of goodwill, which is kind of a stance, a wish, toward yourself. Nothing particularly special or dramatic, simple goodwill. Maybe combined with a thought like, may I be truly happy. Perhaps a thought like, may I be free from suffering and its causes. Letting this wish become increasingly heartfelt. If you like, you might actually put your hand on your heart or your hand on your cheek through what's called embodied cognition, where you do something physical that stimulates a mental state. And then see what it's like to extend the same feeling of heartfelt goodwill to other beings. Maybe individuals in your life, maybe others in this room, maybe all of us in this room or the whole wide world. Perhaps combined with thoughts toward them like, may you be free from suffering and its causes. May you all be truly happy. all right, and then on the basis of this, sort of wholehearted goodwill. The more in the body, in the heart, the more felt it is, the better. On the basis of this goodwill, I'll offer 5 suggestions for... That was not my voice. That's an obvious thing to practice with, isn't it? So there's what? There's whatever there is. There's a shock. There's a wave. And then on the heels of that, as a practice, as a real practice, noticing that you're actually still all right. Seriously, recognizing in the body that you're actually all right, helping the body, the sweet, soft animal of the body, as the poet Mary Oliver puts it. The body's all right. There's breathing. There still may be the shock moving through the body. You know, release the stress hormones from that alarming sound. But alongside that is the knowing that even as the shock proceeds, kind of impersonally, mechanically, it's a sort of cascade to the body mind, that truly you're actually all right. And that recognition that you're actually truly all right, even as the kind of biomechanics of stress and reactivity move through you, is a deep, deep and important practice. Including in that, a recognition of people are taking steps to protect you here. Chris bolted out of his chair like a jackrabbit, making sure this doesn't happen again, one hopes. And also including the reality in the experience of being all right. That things like that can happen. Life includes startling events. And still, there's an ongoingness of being. An ongoingness of fundamental all rightness right now. This is an unintended but wonderful opportunity, really, to observe these 2 tracks almost. There's the sounds and the reactions, especially the sounds. There's content, irritation, fear, thoughts. Why can't they fix that? Who's in charge here? I want a partial refund for the last 7 minutes. Something like that. But also, as well, isn't there? There's the awareness, the field that those contents pass through. And the awareness of the field, which includes a fundamental all rightness, an okayness in your body, living and breathing, ongoing, itself is never disturbed by what passes through. from time to time, life brings shocks, to be sure, to the mind, to the body. And the shocks are unpleasant, usually. Sometimes very unpleasant. And also the unpleasantness passes through a space, a field that represents it, if you will, or in which it emerges, a kind of boundless, edgeless space of awareness. That itself is never tainted or damaged by whatever passes through. And the opportunity increasingly is to abide as the awareness, in a sense identifying increasingly with awareness, with the sky, and less with the clouds that pass overhead. So, the first suggestion for steadying the mind. Set an intention here for your practice. Perhaps an intention to have a steady mind or to be particularly mindful. And you might set that intention top down using language such as a thought soft in the back of your mind. May my mind be steady. May I be mindful here? Or may I learn useful things today? And as well, an intention bottom up, in the sense of getting a sense of what it would be like to fulfill this intention already, or to be someone who is a model for you of whatever the intention is, such as a person who represents for you a good deal of mindfulness. And sort of sinking into or sinking with that exemplar of the state of mindfulness. So set an intention now for this sitting. Feel the intention in your body. What does it feel like to have this intention? In a sense, to abide as this intention, to take refuge even in this intention. Now the second suggestion, and you're welcome to stay with previous suggestion longer if you like as I move through the five. The second suggestion is to really relax. Notice any tension in your body and see if you can start loosening or letting it go. Effective ways to help yourself relax are to do several long exhalations, like to a count of 10, inhaling fairly briefly and then exhaling lengthily 3 or more times. Relax your tongue. Really relax. Now the third suggestion, open to and encourage in your mind, feeling as safe as you reasonably can. In other words, reflect for a moment on being in a relatively protected setting, maybe not safe from intrusive sounds, but safe from lions and tigers and bears. Safe for a moment from dealing with emails and messages. Among good people. Also reflecting on some of your own resources, both inside your mind and body and outside in your life, that help you deal with what life may bring. So that truly you can progressively and appropriately be less braced against life. Notice any needless bracing or needless guarding or needless vigilance. There's no perfect safety in this life, but most people truly can afford to feel reasonably safer. Even as sounds come in, you know, feeling maybe not safe from intrusive sound, still, there's lots of other kinds of safety. And there's an opportunity to help the little animal inside feel as safe as it reasonably can. Then the fourth suggestion, open to and encourage, as you can, a growing sense of well-being. It may be a subtle or mild sense, although it may increasingly have a kind of pervading quality. In other words, deliberately open to and encourage some positive emotion. An effective place, often, to start is with gratitude. Bringing to mind some things that you feel grateful for, or that make you happy. Deliberately calling into awareness those things that bring some happiness to you. There may also be depression, there may also be fear, or anxiety, or irritation. There may be thoughts about controlling the sound here, or what have you. But as well as a kind of concentration practice, try to rest the spotlight of awareness increasingly on those things that bring a sense of happiness right now. To the extent you can, as the Buddha said, letting the sense of happiness, including a subtle and mild sense of happiness, like contentment or ease, fill you like water filling powder in preparation for a bath. noticing any resistance or obstruction to well-being, which is actually quite common. It's all right. And then seeing if you can kind of let it go or see past it or feel past it deliberately to a growing sense of well-being, ease, gratitude, contentment, even happiness filling you. And then the fifth suggestion, as you practice here in this meditation, and in fact throughout this entire day, really sense and intend that the benefits, the positive qualities of mind and body and heart that are being evoked here are sinking into you, gradually weaving into the fabric of your brain and yourself. But for example, right now, to whatever extent there's any positive qualities of mind and heart present, sense that they're sifting down into your being. Maybe visualizing them as a kind of water going down, sinking down into the soil of your mind. Or perhaps light, a golden light coming into you. Or a soothing balm sinking down into you. Touching and soothing and easing old places of pain. In a sense, as you sink into the benefits of your practices, they are sinking into you. Now, on the basis of whatever steadiness of mind has been cultivated here, see if you can pay attention to each and every breath for the next 5 minutes. Applying attention to the beginning of each inhalation and exhalation, and then sustaining attention throughout each inhalation and exhalation, breath after fresh breath. Giving yourself over to, becoming increasingly absorbed in, the simple sensations of breathing, perhaps in the stomach, or chest, or upper lip, or cool air coming in and warm air going out, or the breath altogether, whatever works for you, being present with and sinking into each breath for the next 5 minutes. Anticipation, isn't it? Or as they say in the Rocky Horror Picture Show, anticipation. Is it possible, Chris, I don't know, maybe we're doing it for airflow, but to close those doors, and also obviously to keep trying to lower the temperature in here.
That was the air conditioning.
That was the air conditioning, huh? Well, that's okay. I can limit it. Yeah. Okay. So how was that for you? Why don't we talk a bit about it, obviously, including with that jarring sound. And, you know, what I said about it. So, how was that? Yeah, right there.
I think it was great that that sound actually came in, and then afterwards it was great to me that you said, even though there was that sound, I'm still safe, I'm still alright. And that can apply to all sorts of things in my daily life, that, you know, somebody's in case a mobile phone goes off, or I can, you know, still say, although that sound was there, I'm still fine, everything was still fine. So that's great.
That's good. Good, thank you. Great. Yeah?
Yeah, it's just very interesting. It's not often one puts oneself in a sort of meditative state with you know, with that kind of constant, you know, shocking sound. And I was very aware of kind of these waves, kind of, much more than I've been aware of before, actually, of a kind of, sort of harsh shock during, you know, being very, very with that, feeling almost, feeling exactly where the waves were going into my hands and my arms, and then watching them die away, and then bang, another one. It's very, very interesting.
I know. There's a saying in medicine, you know, good judgment comes from experience, and experience comes from bad judgment. Right? It's a little bit like that. We have these experiences, we would not wish them upon ourselves, yet they tend to carry wonderful lessons. Yeah. And it is interesting, isn't it, to watch the way through the body. This is very biomechanical, literally. You know, with stress hormones. I'm sure if we did blood draws just before and after, which itself could be a stressful thought for many people, including our daughter, who hates having needles take things out of her. But anyway, I'm sure there would be raised cortisol levels, measurably higher, just, and including the anticipation, you know, et cetera. So yeah, but then you can watch it as a, and it's a nice way to appreciate it. It has a mechanical quality. To see it increasingly is, you know, impersonal and mechanical. Okay. One more? Yeah.
Yeah, I often find that in my work, people resistant towards visualizing things. And the question that often
in to them? Do you have a...
Yeah, well, first it sounds like there are sort of three things, you know, and what you said there. First, about visualization, it's really quite true. Some people are very adept at visualization naturally. Some people aren't. And so I think it's helpful when we're teaching or working with clients. How many of you, by the way, are therapists? Yeah, quite a few. So this is really relevant to that. It's important to respect neurological diversity. This is the most fundamental kind of diversity there is, really, in terms of its fundamental impact rather than social constructive impacts. You know. And appreciate that some people really are more auditory or more kinesthetic, not just visual. And I try to do that myself in the way I give suggestions, in the language on them. It's an important point that you say. The second thing is hypnosis, distinct from any kind of deliberate evocation of a state of mind. So, first of all, it's indeed the case that we are deliberate. In certain practices, we simply are trying to be just present with what's there with, as a friend of mine says, as little fabrication as possible. In other words, we're trying to do as little as possible. And that's a great practice, just completely open out to and kind of submit, in a sense, to whatever rolls through and letting it flow. Great. It's also the case, I mean, that's right mindfulness, one of the eight elements of the Eightfold Path. But the Buddha also set forth wise effort, where we are to encourage the wholesome and, you know, increasing, persisting, and arising in the first place, and we are to discourage over time the unwholesome, not morally defined, but pragmatically defined, to encourage the unwholesome to not arise at all or to decrease over time. So there's a place for making efforts for evoking certain states of mind. And particularly since neurons that fire together wire together, the more that we stimulate wholesome states of mind, the more that we do what the Buddha called, or what's traditionally called, bhavana, or cultivation, the more we cultivate, the more we incline the mind in a positive direction. So I think that, just in general terms, it's really useful, I think, to appreciate the place for a kind of an active, positively constructive stance toward our own experience. Not tipping so far into the obvious pitfalls of getting excessively mechanistic or focusing on relentless self-improvement or, you know, getting kind of manipulative with the mind. That's why I said yesterday, in terms of the three great phases of practice, mindfulness, I think, is most fundamental, where we just be with what's there without any kind of fabrication around it. But I think in general terms, there really is a place for deliberately evoking positive states of mind. And I wanted to make that explicit. That was implicit yesterday in what we were doing. I want to make it very explicit today. Suggest to you, you know, see for yourself, of course, if that makes sense to you. But it's the importance to me of taking action inside the mind. Because the truth is, so much of the time, we are at the effect of those forces inside the brain that are laid down in part by evolution, you know, including the inner lizard, the inner monkey, the inner squirrel, the inner caveman, cavewoman, and as well factors that are laid down by our temperament, by our upbringing, by culture, political manipulations, and all the rest. So if we don't take action toward them, they're going to take action toward us. You know, take up arms against your oppressors. Well, where are the oppressors mainly located? Right between the ears, in most cases. So that's a general state. So for me, on that continuum then, I think that when a person, first of all, is activating a positive state of mind themselves, that's anti-hypnotic. Because typically hypnosis is one where someone is taking it. In effect, you voluntarily give up voluntary control, except in the most extreme, you know, sense. And so if a person is doing a practice where they are in charge themselves of what they're calling forth or bringing up, that's very anti-hypnotic. The second thing is that most hypnosis, people define the term narrowly or broadly, in the narrow sense, as a trance state. It's a trance state. Okay. That's, in a sense, anti-mindfulness. I mean, yes, there is often a kind of an observing awareness of the trance state, but having been hypnotized myself into a trance state, you know, mostly you're in the trance. Okay? And that's not mindfulness, that's not a lot of what we do when we're working with people therapeutically. You know, we're not trying to put them into a trance state. If anything, we're trying to disenchant them. If you think of it in Buddhism, one of the main stages of practice is disenchantment. It's waking up from the enchantment. The conventional state of mind, in some sense, is very fraught with enchantment. So we're trying to anti-enchant ourselves. You know? So in that sense as well, I think it would be anti-hypnotic. And then the last part to the third part of your question, which is about, you know, people feeling, and again, I encountered this myself as well, as a practicing therapist and a teacher and so on. People go, well, it's not real if I'm making it up. I'm like, what do you mean? Do you mean that it's real when people make it up for you? You know, when you watch someone on TV who irritates you or fascinates you, and, you know, they make up a set of reactions, you're walking down the street and someone's friendly and that engenders reactions, and, you know, or someone's rude and that engenders other reactions. Obviously, those are just arising, you know, causes and conditions. So I think that it's perfectly legitimate to evoke or engender experiences, really positive ones, in the mind. We're having all kinds of negative experiences in the mind, triggered all day long, right? And the mind takes the shape of what it rests upon. The brain takes the shape of what the mind rests upon. When we rest upon those negative experiences that are activated in awareness, we are building out the neural substrates of anxiety, depression, inadequacy, pessimism, and sensitivity to stress. Because stress today sensitizes the brain to more stress tomorrow in a vicious cycle. There are a variety of pathways and feedback loops whereby feeling upset or irritated or anxious is a stressor. Right? If we feel angry about anything, or disturbed, or shocked by sounds, whatever, that triggers the same kind of stress machinery that was devised over, you know, millions of years, hundreds of millions of years, to deal with real leopards leaping out of the bushes. You know, it's the same machinery when a sound goes off like that. It's very, very powerful. Well, when that machinery gets active and it releases cortisol, the cortisol that's released sensitizes the amygdala, which is the alarm bell in the brain, which is already primed to go negative because about two-thirds of its cells track unpleasant experiences in terms of the vagueness or the feeling tone, moment-to-moment experience. The amygdala is primed to go negative. And also, cortisol weakens the hippocampus, which is a part of the brain that does visual spatial memory, and which also puts the brakes on the amygdala. It inhibits the amygdala, and the hippocampus inhibits cortisol production. That means that cortisol today sensitizes the alarm bell and it weakens the brakes on alarmist reactions. So that tomorrow, we're even more sensitive to stress, which makes us even more sensitive the day after tomorrow. See, those are negative reactions. That's happening all day long, right? What are we going to do? We're just going to roll. One of the main things we can do is deliberately engender positive reactions or initiate or open to and encourage. Now, the way I think about it is that at any moment in time, there's a kind of a range of what's authentically possible. Obviously, if you've just gotten terrible news about a loved one, it's not the time to open up to encourage positive well-being by thinking of everything you're grateful for. That would be ridiculous, okay? And I found often as a therapist, you know, I've learned my lesson as well as a parent of teenagers and now young adults, that when people are, and a long-time husband, there's certain points where, you know, well-meaning suggestions like, look on the bright side of life. You don't want to smack you, you know? So, but my point is, and we can, and when we do this for ourselves, we can feel there's an authentic range. Sometimes, honestly, trying to open to or encourage anything positive is like trying to create a bonfire with wet firewood. It's not going to work, all right? There's that range. My question is, are we working at the upper end or the low end of the range of what's possible of any moment in time? So we want to be in that range. Above that range would be fun, okay? But as long as we're in that range, and that range moves up or down depending on the circumstances, moment to moment for a person, the state of being, their state of mind, how long it's been since they ate, you know, what have you. But if we work within that range, then it's completely legitimate. To me, you raise extremely important, excellent points and questions about the whole notion of self-directed neuroplasticity. The whole notion of being on one's own side in terms of gradually cultivating the factors of the wholesome. And my personal opinion, having been in sort of, you know, the Buddhist world for quite a while now, a number of decades, I think there's been a tendency to some extent in the West, as Buddhism came to the West, particularly in its more Southeast Asian tradition, that way, not Tibetan Buddhism particularly, which is quite focused on cultivating qualities. But more of its Vipassana or even Zen side, which is really emphasized the receptive, bare awareness aspect of Buddhism. there's a great place for them. I think that's primary. I want to be clear, I think that's primary. But it left out all these other very important aspects of, you know, shaping the mind. Actively shaping the mind. Actively taking action. And I think the more one understands the negativity bias of the brain due to evolution, the more it inclines toward the negative, the more it's hardwired towards suffering, as a fantastic strategy to produce gene copies that allows these strategies for quality of life. The more one understands that, and also the more one understands the pernicious effects of crummy upbringings, you know, mediocre school systems, tacky jobs, the, you know, living life in a way that's absolutely distinct from the evolutionary template of a hunter-gatherer culture, where people moved, where life moved at the pace of a walk, and people were in community. Yes, they faced terrible illnesses, starvation, and all the rest of that, but so much of that life, you know, was very positive and protective. We have very little of that in most of our culture today. The village it takes to raise a child is most often a ghost town, particularly in the West, especially in America, where I come from. Very often. So the more one understands that, and the more one understands also the pernicious effects in the brain of modern culture, you know, the pace of it, the intensity of it, the endless demands for activation and response, which we did not evolve to handle chronically. Right? And the more one understands also the pernicious effects of politics, which endlessly beats the drumbeat of fear. You know, talk about the shock that goes through us. You know, that shock, those shocks are produced manipulatively, continually, because it's a great way to get a populace that is afraid and is therefore willing to put up with almost anything to be protected. The more one appreciates that, to me, and the more that also one is interested in the upper reaches of human potential, and the higher hills and mountains and snowy peaks of the waking, the more one is interested in that, the more one naturally wants to take action, to initiate, to be a cause in the mind and therefore the brain toward one's own well-being. That alone is, to me, my heartfelt hope is something that, you know, I can share with you and to, you know, nourish the flames of that fire in everyone's heart in this room. Not that you don't already have it, but to whatever extent we can put another log on the fire today. I think that's a good thing. So if I could, I'd like to talk about what was happening in the brain to some extent while we were doing that. And we'll take a little break. This is an illustration of the general idea that you can do things with your mind and gradually change your brain over time. All right? And so, first off, if you set an intention, you do it top-down and activates, you know, prefrontal systems, particularly if you're using language, those are basically where the executive systems of the brain are located, kind of the inner chair of the committee, sometimes, unfortunately, the inner dictator. But it's also important to have intention that's from the bottom up. Usually we think of setting intentions as verbally, top-down, executive-focused. It's actually more powerful to set them from the bottom up, to, in effect, channel a positive state or someone who embodies that state. I've done a lot of rock climbing, and one thing I would do sometimes is I would watch someone who was a much better climber, kind of, you know, moving across the rock like a gecko or something. And then I would feel what it would be like in my own body to be like that. Then I'd go climb, and I would climb a lot better. So setting an intention bottom up, either imagining in a felt way what it would be like to manifest that intention, or channeling or tuning into someone who is an exemplar of that intention, it's a very powerful way to set intentions, including it every day. You know, I remember coming across this practice in a Tibetan magazine in which a person just kind of passing as an aside talked about each day reestablishing the intention for awakening or the intention for relieving beings from suffering or simply the intention to be reasonably happy, right? Whatever it is, the idea of resetting the intention, recommitting to it, giving oneself over to it again, to one's higher purposes, to the better angels of one's nature every day. That's a beautiful thing to do. So that's the first one. And one way to give over is, of course, to feel it as a present reality, in a sense to take refuge in it, as I said. Second, relaxing the body. It's really hard to meditate. And by the way, when we set an intention for steadiness of mind, we incline the mind in that direction. Okay. Second, it's really hard to meditate and be concentrated, especially if we're all keyed up and anxious and nervous. So step one to that is to relax the body. That energizes or activates the parasympathetic wing of the autonomic nervous system, which is part of the nervous system. Pardon me, that handles kind of regulation and equilibrium. Well, the parasympathetic wing is connected to the sympathetic nervous system, the stress response, fight or flight wing, kind of like a seesaw. When one goes up, the other one goes down. So if we activate the parasympathetic wing, it downregulates the sympathetic wing. And the rest and digest parasympathetic wing is triggered by exhaling. So some long exhalations are a nice little trick. It's also, since it's rest and digest, it's activated when we relax the tongue, because digestion begins in the mouth, and there are a lot of parasympathetic fibers in the mouth. Touching one's lips also helps, in part, as well, because it brings up secondary associations to things like feeding, hopefully it went well, nursing, breastfeeding, and so forth. A little trick, I'll admit it, not ashamed of it. Sometimes tell myself sleep. If I really need to, I'll put a knuckle on my lip. Just to kind of help soothe my... I'm not sucking my thumb. That would be really great. But a knuckle on the lip, A plus. Okay. Feeling safer. It's kind of hard when the blaring noise is happening. It could come again at any moment. You know. But deep practice is to appreciate a growing sense of safety, even knowing that something can happen at any moment. But again, it's hard to be to bring attention inward if we're feeling uneasy. It's interesting that in the Buddha's own awakening, he talked about sitting with his back to the Bodhi tree. You know, the tree had his back, because that's where most threats come. It's either purely a coincidence or a wonderful metaphor that because the tree had his back, the forces of delusion, embodied or literally or metaphorically, the embodiment of delusion, confusion and delusion, ignorance being the fundamental source of suffering. So the fundamental source of suffering was coming at the Buddha this way, and he could deal with it because it was out here. So it's interesting how often the traditional instructions in the Dharma have to do with finding a place of seclusion, in other words, safety, and getting settled. So normally, because of evolution, we're quite vigilant. That evolutionary tendency gets aggravated in various ways due to personal temperament, personal history, modern culture, and politics. So we tend to be, most people feel much less safe than they can reasonably afford to feel. So I'm not talking about perfect safety, but allowing yourself and helping yourself is a kind of kindness and also a kind of deliberate intention that promotes steadiness of mind to help oneself gradually feel as safe as one reasonably can. To not be so braced against life, to not be so guarded, to not be so vigilant, to bring the sentinels in from the battlements so they can rest, if nothing else, and also go to work in terms of deepening and concentration. That practice, helping oneself feel appropriately safer, is a great deep practice for daily life. And it's something one can engage in almost any moment. Walking down the street, noticing that I actually can afford to feel a little safer than I presently do. Realistically, I can. You know, in evolution and in life, there are two great mistakes, right? On the one hand, we can think there is a tiger in the bushes, but there really is no tiger, the coast is clear. Or alternately, we can think that everything is fine, everything is groovy, but there really is a tiger there that depends. Two mistakes. Mother Nature wants us to make the first mistake 1,000 times over to avoid making the second mistake even once. The cost of the first mistake is generalized anxiety disorder, or, you know, extremes of phobias or so forth, right? Or just general sense of uneasiness, apprehensiveness, and anxiety. That's a cost, but that doesn't matter too much to Mother Nature because she doesn't really care about long-term effects. As long as you have babies by your 16th birthday in the Serengeti, you're good to go, especially if you live to be a grandparent around age 35. After that, she doesn't care, right? Because you're not really contributing very much to the probability of passing on genes. But today, I don't know, I won't ask for a show of hands for those who are over 35. I expect this more than half the room. It's definitely me over here, 58. I'm interested in living long and well. And I think a lot of us are. So it makes sense to pay attention to the impact of chronic stress, which is really triggered and exacerbated and intensified by what I call paper tiger paranoia. We're endlessly paranoid or uneasy about tigers that are not really there. And actually, being preoccupied with tigers that are not really there can distract us from tigers that really are there. Right? It's important to deal with real tigers. Okay. So, evoking positive emotion, that's a very interesting one. Let me explain a little bit how attention works in the brain. Because if you're interested in, right, we want to be mindful, we want to concentrate the mind, that means attention. Well, how does attention work? And a major component of attention has to do with working memory. Working memory being kind of the mental chalkboard, which any moment is sort of like what people might call the neural substrates of consciousness. And a major aspect of those neural substrates of awareness, and what's in the field of awareness, are in the upper outer frontal regions of the brain. Those are the neural substrates, if you will, of the mental chalkboard, or a critical aspect. And what enters that chalkboard, or what gets represented in those substrates, is gated by a neurotransmitter, dopamine. Dopamine is a key neurotransmitter. Here's how the gate works. If dopamine levels are steady, the gate's closed. If dopamine levels drop, the gate opens. It's also the case that dopamine levels spike, the gate opens. All right? To use an example, imagine a monkey in a tree. All right? So the monkey's in the tree eating bananas. It's good in this tree. Nice steady stream of bananas, which means a steady stream of dopamine, because dopamine tracks rewards. Experiences are rewarding, or expectations of reward are fulfilled, dopamine levels stay steady. So here's a monkey in this tree eating his bananas, not needing to think about other treats with bananas, because there are plenty of bananas in this tree. Staying focused on this tree. In other words, steady dopamine puts a gate to working memory, so no new information comes in. No barbarians at the gate are allowed to enter. No intruders allowed. All right? Steady dopamine gates the neural substrates of working memory, which translates to steadiness of mind. In this case, steady focus on the object of concentration, the bananas in this tree. Right? On the other hand, now then let's suppose that the supply of bananas diminishes or runs out in this tree. Right? So now over time, the rewards of this tree drop, therefore dopamine levels drop, therefore the gate opens, and the monkey starts noticing all the other trees with bananas nearby. It's a very effective strategy to help organisms, help animals focus on what they need to focus on or shift their focus to something else. Alternately, let's suppose the bananas working, or the monkeys working away and the bananas in the tree, which share 20% of its DNA, but anyway, it's kind of a cannibalism, sort of like genetic cannibalism. Okay, so working away on the bananas in this tree, and then this cute other monkey, hoo-hoo, swings into a branch nearby. Oh, babies, reward spikes, you know, dopamine spikes, new opportunity for rewards, what bananas, hey, what's your sign? Or something like that. Anyway, so, see how that works? So then there's an opportunity to look for even sweeter rewards, dopamine spikes. Well, translating that to this suggestion, opening to and encouraging positive emotion, the more that we experience positive emotion, which can be quite subtle. It's important to appreciate. It can be subtle, yet even pervading, for example. It can be awash in mild yet pervading well-being. Anyway, by opening to and encouraging positive emotion, we get what? We get steady levels of dopamine. That helps gate working memory so we can stay focused on the breath. Working memory is gated, so fewer distracting thoughts can enter. There's less engagement with stimuli outside ourselves that would be distracting, and less opportunity for stimuli coming up from within to break through into awareness, the focused field of attention, because we're experiencing rewards. And even better, if we start to experience very high levels of well-being, really just kind of given over to a sort of saturation in various nuances of well-being, like gratitude, or heartfeltness, or love, or contentment, or just happiness, thinking about things that make you happy, or even deep tranquility, what the Buddha called the highest happiness, which is peace. As we do that, dopamine levels start rising, and they approach their ceiling. In other words, as positive emotion gets increasingly intense, dopamine rises so far that you cannot get a spike. It's at the top of range. And I think that's the neurological reason why, traditionally, two of the five factors of deep absorption involve great positive emotion. The five factors traditionally for absorption are applied attention, sustained attention, bliss or rapture, positive emotion. I won't use the finger that's involved in that as I count it out. And then happiness or joy, which is on a spectrum from happiness to contentment to tranquility. Two of the five factors involve very high levels of positive emotion. And I think that's the reason why, is that that really helps steady concentration, really supports concentration. The last factor is the singleness of mind, a sense of everything kind of coming together as one whole gestalt. So that's why I did that practice. And I think that's one reason why it's helpful. And then the last is to really sense and intend that the benefits of practice, whatever they are sinking in. In other words, that over time, they're sifting down into us, being resources that we can take with us wherever we go. As I said yesterday, a little bit, I'll say it more clearly today, the brain is biased toward negative experiences. There are dedicated memory systems that just track negative experiences instantly. But positive experiences, including the positive benefits of contemplative practice or spiritual life altogether, or realizations in life and so on, those positive benefits are just simply the pleasure of seeing a field of roses, or eating, hanging out with friends, or having a sense of relief and ease, etc. Those positive experiences do not transfer to long-term storage, unless they're million-dollar moments, unless they're held in awareness for a dozen or two dozen or three dozen seconds in a row. Otherwise, they don't transfer from short-term memory buffers to long-term storage. That means as we go through life, moment to moment to moment, negative experiences are caught instantly, while positive ones tend to flow through the mind and therefore the brain, like water through a sieve. That's why it's very important to deliberately use mindfulness to stay with positive experiences for 10, 20, 30 seconds in a row. So that instead of, them sifting through the mind, they stay with us. But the default setting of the brain is to be like Velcro for negative experiences, but Teflon for positive. That's why it's so important to use this fifth suggestion here to reverse that, to make the mind and therefore the brain increasingly like Velcro for the positive and Teflon for the negative. Any questions or comments so far? Yeah.
I was just elaborate on because this extension to the fact that in a state of absorption, such as heightened positive emotion and alertness, there's also an element of single mindedness where all the perfect have come into purely just self. And things like the normal description of.
I'm smiling. First, as always, you ask these really great questions, and I'm conscious of time too, and so I'll be very succinct about that. First, the distinction you're making is a very good one, and one that's commonly used between, in a sense, two kinds of meditation, either what's called open awareness, which is people often describe as vipassana meditation, although that's actually a misnomer because vipassana just means insight. And insight can arise, and very often does arise, most liberatingly, most freeingly, in states of deep absorption. But open awareness, where we're just kind of allowing whatever to flow through the mind, while resting some attention, usually, on some object like the breath, to help give us a kind of an anchor. Okay? Then there are the other kinds called focused attention, where we really drill down into something. Both are very important. Okay. So when we do, and it's, again, it's, I think it's important to appreciate, at least from my perspective, I don't know what it's been like in Great Britain, but in America, as Buddhism came in, it really emphasized, at least in the Vipassana traditions, the Theravadan tradition, the Southeast Asian traditions that, that Jack Kornfield and Christina Feldman were trained in, and Joseph Goldstein and other people were trained in. It really emphasized open awareness, but I think excessively. You know, I didn't even know there was such a thing as concentration or absorption until Christina pointed it out to me. You know, and I had a lot of experience with Buddhism before then, in America at least. In other words, it's not the Noble Sevenfold Path, right? It's the Eightfold Path, and the Eighth listed is right concentration, which is tantamount to the four jhanas. Right concentration is the jhanas, these four non-ordinary, quite profound states of awareness or experience. So it's important to really appreciate the centrality of steadying the mind to practice. Really learning how to get control of that spotlight of attention so it stops wiggling around. So you can rest it on something and laser-like look really deep down into the fundamental causes of suffering and therefore liberation from suffering. Okay? Steadiness of mind, very important. My own practice really took off, actually, speaking personally, in particular, when I started focusing on steadiness of mind and the cultivation of positive emotion as a means to an end. Again, there are pitfalls. We can get attached to it. We can get focused on performance around it. We can be self-critical about it. But just because there are pitfalls on the path doesn't mean we don't walk the path. Just try not to fall off the path. Okay. So now your question is, what is the neural substrate of the fifth factor? I was afraid you're going to go there. Well, that's a very interesting question. I've actually thought a lot about it. Super fast. You might see me talk a little bit about this in the equanimity chapter of my book. No, actually, it's the one on mindfulness later on. I think it's like the 10th chapter or something. But anyway, I suspect that that fifth factor, which experientially, kind of quickly here, and you can do this at home. You can do the five factors at home. It's hard to drop into a real jhana at home, you know. But you can do the five factors, and they're really worth cultivating. Applying attention, sustaining attention, opening to a kind of rapture in the body. Some people are quite accessible to that. Some people are not. It's okay if you're not. But especially opening to joy is a factor. And then a kagyu, which is the Pali term for singleness of the mind. But it feels like it's kind of like suddenly everything is one whole percepting experience. Rather than attention, it's like the field of awareness is like a stage. You know, and it's what's on the stage. What's in the focal spotlight is what we're particularly aware of right now. And the spotlight kind of moves around different objects on the stage, moment to moment, typically. When we're in a state of this unification of consciousness, it's like the spotlight suddenly opens out to the whole stage all at once as one coherent moment of experience, one unified gestalt or percept. And with that is typically a real quietness of mind, not much verbal thought, if any, and a sense of equanimity, and a kind of ease. It sort of takes on a life of its own. It kind of persists. I think that that correlates a lot with gamma wave brain activity. Gamma wave brain waves are brain waves that are firing very rapidly, 30 to 80 times a second. And there are studies that show that people who have long-term practice, who can fairly readily tip into the state of unification of awareness, have a lot more gamma wave activity. In other words, they are able to synchronize large swaths of the brain very tightly. Because when you get neural assemblies firing in synchrony across large swaths of neural real estate, which is kind of like everybody between here and Birmingham clapping in unison 30 to 80 times a second. Can you imagine that? That would be the equivalent, really, in terms of scaling up the microscopic scale of the brain, where you could put five neural cell bodies side by side in the midst of the human hand. So when you get a lot of gamma wave activation, you're getting an entrainment or a synchronization or an integration of large swaths of the brain, which translate to the experience of a lot of integration of large swaths of awareness. And so I'll just tell you ways to tip into that are neurological tricks. So that's my, I'm a trickster, but no, I'm a Methodist guy, right? Maybe a trickster too. This is a place for coyote, right? What? In the English folklore tradition, is there an equivalent? Trickster, whatever, you know? All traditions have trickster figures. I love Lear's Fool. That's one of my favorite tricksters.
The fox.
Okay, the fox. Perfect, yeah. Yeah, that's good. The inner fox. I think it's a place for the inner fox, along with the iguana and monkey and banana. But anyway, so a way into this, right, where you're being resourceful with your own mind, is to try to feel the body as a whole. Anything that takes you into gestalt awareness, feel the breath as a whole, the whole breath, not just the breath experienced in the belly or the chest or the throat or the nose, the breath as a whole. It's hard to sustain that sense of the breath as a whole for more than a second or two, then it crumbles. But with practice, you can drop into it more and more. It's a kind of letting go into it, like everything as a whole. And then see if you can extend from the breath as a whole to the body as a whole. And then the natural next step is to all the experience as a whole, as a gestalt. That's a nice practice into that. You said you're opening the gate. In a sense, you're right. You're opening the gate, and then you're closing it after. You're trying to open to the breath as a whole, and then stabilize that experience. Right? And then open to the body as a whole, stabilize that experience. Those are nice pathways into singleness of mind. And also, which is founded, of course, on a real steadiness of awareness too. Okay? Hopefully that was practically useful. Because, again, the jhana factors are really doable. And sitting in your living room, you know, wherever you meditate, very doable. And it's even possible, particularly if you have, you know, a significant meditative practice, to tip into the fifth jhana factor, even in your living room. And that illustrates larger points of, first, different ways to support the neural substrates of steadiness of mind, and by supporting them, by stimulating them, increasingly strengthen them over time. So your mind really does become steadier. My mind's a lot steadier today than it was 5 years ago, or even probably a year ago. So you can do this. In other words, work the muscle. The more we work the muscle, the more we build it. And the bigger the muscle gets, the more weight we can lift. Same thing happens in the brain. The second point here is that I've given you suggestions for how you can actually activate these jhana factors, including the last one, which is in some ways the most challenging. Okay, and that illustrates the larger point, of course, of using the mind to change the brain, to change the mind for the better, in targeted ways. We kind of do reverse engineering. We think, okay, what could plausibly be, as I did with the gamma wave entrainment thing, what could plausibly be in the neural substrates of wholesome states of mind, and then how can we foster those? I just think that's the coolest opportunity, you know, these days. Particularly at a time, you know, the more we can have a sense of influence, not control, but more influence over the black box here, right? Particularly at a time when so many of us feel so buffeted by large-scale social forces that we have seemingly less and less control over every day. You know, it's a wonderful thing to feel that you have increasing influence over the most fundamental organ in your body. You know, the final common pathway, really, of all the causes and conditions streaming through us that create either suffering or its end. Let's take a 10-minute break, okay? Come back, and I'll resume promptly. How about we take a 12-minute break?
Yeah.
Start at 12. Okay, see you soon.